Blog Talk Radio.
Radio program. I'm Susan Laris and Dan, and I am just so delighted to welcome you all back here today or whenever you're listening to the podcast in the future, because quite honestly, I don't think that I could even quite capture the true essence of today's guest in any show description or any introduction. But I am just so thrilled to have Nick Seneca Jankel here today, and I'll bring him on the line in just a moment. He has just written a new book called Switch On, Unleash Your Creativity and Thrive with the New Science and Spirit of Breakthrough. And I will have to say, as I've been reflecting on what I have captured from this book so far, it's not just entirely new, as I managed to describe it before. It's actually based in many things that are entirely old and have been with us forever. And let me just tell you a little bit about Nick. Nick has so many amazing accomplishments that I couldn't even begin to express them all. He has worked for major corporations, starting very early in his career, assisting with the marketing campaigns for things such as the Xbox. He even recently gave a keynote at number 10 Downing Street, having an influence on government leaders on our very world. And I think that any write-up regarding what Nick has done can't perhaps capture where he was some years ago and where he is now, because that's really very important, because you can see how his socially conscious views came more and more into play throughout his career. I could say so much more. He was a psychological coach in a four-part BBC TV series. He has coached a major celebrity on an MTV show. He's done other work for the BBC and just so much work with various companies. He has a triple first, and those in the U.S. who don't know, because I wasn't quite sure what a triple first is, from the University of Cambridge, but it's kind of like summa cum laude, and he is a serial entrepreneur, as we will find, and he's a parent. And most of all, he is an incredibly inspiring individual. And without any more delay, I am just so delighted to bring Nick Jankel on the line. Welcome, Nick.
Hi. Thanks very much for having me.
Well, I'm very happy to have you here today. And I think that a way of revealing the essence of you that came to me immediately through your book, Nick, was your story of being, you know, kind of a geeky kid, which many of us can relate to. I was a computer scientist, so you know, so I've known plenty of geeks, and I was a geek, and you were a raver. And that experience, which we probably should define what it is for people who don't know what that is, switched you on. So
well,
I wonder
if
you could start with that.
Yeah, it was one of the experiences that caused me to realize that within our biology, the capacity to feel totally aligned, totally connected to the universe, and totally supported at certain moments. Now, people often call these things peak experiences, or we have them in meditation or whatever. And so my sort of logical mind went, well, hold on a minute. If I can access them in these sort of special moments, then surely I can access them in any moment. Surely if the wiring is there, if the nervous wiring is there, then I have the capacity to learn how to use it properly.
Yeah.
And as someone who was a medic at the time, that seemed totally, and still does seem totally logical. So the journey has been, okay, great. So how, you know, how come I feel so unconnected, disconnected, and disharmonious, and stuck, and stressed, and irritated, and a bit down, and all those rich emotions? How come I feel like that most of the time? So that was the sort of 20-year start point journey to master my capacity, so I could, and then teach it to others. As I learned and got more resource myself, I started realizing, well, hold on a minute, this is what every child in the world should be taught as their only, really the most important thing they should be taught. And everything else comes after that. And of course, as you mentioned, I left Cambridge with really a fabulous degree, a degree that most people would be envious of, but it gave me no insight into how to live life at all, really.
Yeah.
And I think that's a bit of a travesty, and that still galvanizes my work as an entrepreneur in the wisdom space.
Yes. Nick, you know, one of the reasons I appreciate the way you started your book is it kind of links to the end where you talk about the spirit of play. And I'm wondering if by hooking into that, even before you quite knew what it was you were doing and releasing, it just seems like it's amazing the keys, I think, that we find on our life journeys. And I think that's a really remarkable, honest key to finding that entry point to play and to joy.
Definitely. I mean, I think a lot of people get sucked into the belief that personal work, inner work, including work on areas of pain and suffering within us, you know, the fundamental wounds we have, has to be really serious and earnest. And if you go into the psychotherapy tradition, that is kind of the tone of therapy. It's a very earnest place to be, and it's a very earnest profession. And that turned me off completely. I had psychotherapy from 13 to 16, so 3 years of weekly psychotherapy, and it just was so boring. And it was boring not only because it was so earnest, but also because what we really did was just talk over and over and over again about the wounds and the problems, rather than looking at how to break through them. And so when I started getting more and more involved in this work, I realized that if the moments where we're most free, we could describe them as play, and scientists have tried to describe play in different ways, but one of them is learning without consequence, of learning without fear, learning without any worry, which actually taps into a lot of the wisdom traditions around not being attached to the fruits of our labors, to the outcome of things. We're in play, and then when we're in play, we're not worried about who thinks we're good or bad, or whether we're liked or not liked. We're just playing for the sake of curiosity. And that, if we can capture that spirit in, you know, a Tuesday meeting, or doing our expenses report on a Sunday night, you know, if we can capture that spirit of play, then we've kind of almost hacked the whole enlightenment experience, because we're kind of in it, whether we've, you know, studied for 20 years meditation or not.
Yes. Yeah, something else that you mentioned that really made me reflect, just thinking about even times that I've been in the corporate world and just in life in general, is how when we're in that space of play, and you used that example of dance at the beginning, but how there's no class, how everybody's equal. And, you know, something I observed in corporations when I used to work in the corporate world was how there was a desire to connect often. You know, if you were a leader, you really wanted to connect with your people. I know a guy who leads a store in our community, for example, and he's a rock singer, and he wants to sing at this big festival. And I told him, oh, that would be so cool. You know, he has all these people who work for him in our community. And there's something there, Nick. There's something really magical there that allows us to connect and create together.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, couldn't agree more. And in fact, that dance energy is something that I've been working on with my wife's a professional choreographer and dancer and dance therapist, and we've been working on a mixture of raving meets deep transformational process that we're taking to a lot of festivals this summer, actually, to start to bring a lot of people into this work who don't necessarily think about it as something that they're particularly interested in. And you can do, with dance and music, you can do things that you can't do with language, because it slips beneath the radar of cynicism and fear and doubt.
Yes.
It just pulls you in with a beat, and it just makes your body move. And, you know, people are sucked into it without really even realizing what they're doing. But most dance floors in most parties and festivals and clubs, they're just the joy lasts for the moment of the dance.
Yes.
And what I've been trying to do in my work is say, well, how do you feel that joy, that community, that dance when you're on your own?
Yes.
You're not feeling particularly great. How do you access that collaborative community unity, the union of oneself with others? And that brought me very much into the spiritual paths, but I struggled. You know, I kicked and screamed with that. I was brought up really quite atheistic in my family, quite science based, and I had an allergy to New Age, New Age languaging really.
Yeah.
And it took me a long time to embrace this path, because I had to find a language for it that I could use with myself without sort of laughing at myself, that I could use with others.
Yes.
You know, and as you mentioned in the intro, I work in with some pretty grown-up, serious people, and I can't just walk in talking about energy and you know, spirit guides and things. I have to I've had to work really hard to, A, integrate my wisdom understanding with science so that it's state-of-the-art, then integrate it with myself in language so it flows in the world people are in. So you go to them, not making them come to you. And that's why it's taking so long. And so the book took a decade to write because of that. It would be much easier to write if I just sort of said, right, I'm going to write a very typical niche book. But I didn't want to. I wanted to write a book that was both an opening to spirit for people who just don't think of themselves as spiritual. But I also was very keen to really bring the science together. And at the moment, as far as I know, there's no book out on the market, spiritual or not, that brings together all the science of human thriving, as I've attempted to do. And the last 10 years, I've seen an absolute explosion in scientific papers on empathy, altruism, gratitude, compassion, addiction, etc., etc. We're getting so much more insight into how the biology works. And the great news in my reading of it is that it totally and utterly is compatible with a profound, deep spirituality.
Yes.
And that is very exciting, because it means we can bring these two worlds together, science and spirit.
Yes.
And don't have to be apart anymore.
Yes. Yes, I have to say I appreciate that we are starting to build these bridges, because that's really what you're doing. And it's true that language can put people off. You know, we're all taught certain things. We have certain biases, maybe. We come from different points of view. I mean, I came from a very conservative religious point of view, and then also scientific, because I kind of rejected that and went both ways. And so I know exactly, if for us to communicate with one another, sometimes we have to get beyond those preconceptions, and you find the core essence of what is real. I mean, that's what it seems that you've you've captured. And, you know, you say, I know this term thrive, you know, not just the term, but what it really means to thrive, which you've already mentioned. I'd like you to explore that a little more deeply.
Sure.
Yes, please do.
So I think we got a bit lost a few years back in this conversation when everyone started talking about happiness. And for me, happiness is a bit of a red herring for a number of reasons. One is it feels to me it's sort of talking about experiencing positivity at all times. And I don't necessarily believe that that's actually an appropriate way of living. If someone dies, I don't want to be positive about it. I want to see meaning in it, and I want to have, I don't want to be suffering with it. But I want to be pretending it's great, when actually my whole being wants to grieve and to be sad and to cry and to release them from me. And so the idea of being happy at that moment is kind of nuts to me. And it's almost dangerous. It's almost saying that we should create a veneer of happiness over our problems. What thriving means to me is saying, well, even in the midst of that absolute terror of getting divorced, or the horror of a child being ill, even in those moments where we have deep, profound emotions that are designed to help us deal with the situation in the evolutionary term, we can still be in the middle of our life, embracing life, not scared, not turned away, not shut down, not switched off. We can still be on, open, available, huge, big, juicy, joyous, rich, whilst being sad or pained or you know, in some ways not necessarily typically happy. And so that's what thriving means to me. So thriving is about being able to take on massive problem or massive awesome moment and still be able to be equally alive with both. So it touches into what some of the Eastern traditions talk about in terms of equanimity, which is, you know, the ability to be able to take everything, good or bad, and remain relatively even keeled with it. But for me, thriving is a bit more exciting than that. It's like equanimity. Yes. It's like energetic equanimity. It's a sort of rich equanimity. It's a sort of optimistic equanimity rather than a kind of totally flat equanimity.
Do you feel that, you know, as I reflect upon it, that it's finding the joy, just being in that space of joy, even not empty joy, like happiness joy, that we talked about, but I mean, just, or maybe it's both joy and peace, because I know you talk about peace as well.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm not
definitely
sure it can be placed into words. It's alive.
So when I was, exactly, it's aliveness. I mean, when I was about 3 or 4 years ago going through a divorce and co-parenting my son, and there were moments where there were lawyers talking about, you know, taking my son away from me. Oh, and that, for me, is like a horrendous thought.
Absolutely, for anyone.
But even in those moments, I could still say, you know what, I'm alive. This is amazing to be just in this moment. And then to looking at, well, what can I learn from it? Where's the meaning here? What could I become curious about? How can I use it to free myself from the fear of losing a child, so that I'm free of that forever? That's what thriving is to me. It's about saying, this sucks, and yet it's probably got some amazing growth potential in it for me, so that I can talk to a lawyer without getting angry because I'm no longer hooked by the fear of losing my son, which of course makes you much better at negotiating anyway. So that's what I mean by thriving. It's about taking these intense experiences, whatever they are, and rather than labeling them good or bad, just seeing them as intense and saying, I know there is a potential for me to become more either more loving, more truthful, or more creative, and usually all three.
You know, something that I think that a lot of people will do in that situation, which is not what you're talking about, is they will find a way to make themselves numb. And then maybe they don't experience whatever's going on. I mean, but what you're talking about is fully experiencing even incredibly challenging situations and not going numb.
Yes. Well, I mean, the general rule is you've got three options with every experience of life. You either react to it and you act out, and that could be by running away or getting angry, either. You can repress it, make it numb, make yourself numb, pretend it doesn't matter to you, which, I mean, I just look around me and I see so much repression going on, so much frozenness.
Yeah.
Or you can go, okay, let's take it on and switch on to it. So that's the way the beginning of Switch On is, the book is about saying that at that moment you have a choice and you can take this on. You can, I use the word metabolize, which is obviously a biological world. When a cell takes in food and turns it into energy, you can metabolize any experience and turn it into meaning within you if you take it in and don't try and push it away or pretend it's not there. And I was actually very influenced. So my two of my grandparents are Holocaust survivors. And so I didn't want to come into the market, if you like, with a life philosophy, with teachings, until I had run them through the mill of the worst experiences human beings can have. For example, being in Auschwitz. I didn't want it to be a kind of positivity, oh, it's all going to be okay. Because actually, it isn't always okay in terms of people do die and people do get cancer and people are murdered and all these things. So for me, I had to work out how do you apply these teachings so that you're not saying... So for example, people say everything happens for a reason.
Yeah.
That's a very strong statement. And what I would say is everything happens in an interconnected sort of orchestration, a symphony, and you can create meaning from it. Doesn't necessarily mean it happens for a reason in a kind of very linear way, because I can't walk around saying that 6 million people died for a reason. It doesn't make sense to me. But 6 million people died because there was a fear from one side and a fear from the other side, and you can see that that could interact in a certain way, and you could almost predict it, and at the same time you could still make meaning from it and come out of it, as Viktor Frankl talks about in his seminal work, Man's Search for Meaning, which I quote at the beginning of the book, saying, you know, don't just take this as kind of, you know, positive thinking pap. You know, this is something that I've really seriously engaged in for many years. And if Viktor Frankl can be in Auschwitz and say, you know, you still have a choice, whether you run away scared or you look to serve someone else with love, then we all do at every moment, and no matter how awful our life is. So, that's very important.
Nick, you know, when we talk about major world events like that, and I'm even thinking about, you know, that's the macrocosm, but even the microcosm of our lives, we can all see these situations where we fall into patterns of blame. It's really, we just think, you know, if that person hadn't stabbed me in the back, there's the microcosm. Or, you know, there's all, or, you know, in a big worldwide scale, I mean, we can think of some really, really major ways that it deeply, deeply hurt. I mean, so what do we do with that, I guess? What do we do with that blame cycle that we get caught in?
Yeah, the shame, blame, complain cycle, which is the ego, what I call the tiny me, getting all righteous about our wrongness, or someone else's wrongness. And it's and it's always asking the same questions, which is, why has this happened to me? Why is the world never supporting me? Why does the universe not look after me? Why is not God not here for me? Why, you know, it only has those kind of questions. That's just any questions it can ask. And therefore, the answers are only really disempowering. There's never really any value in any of the answers, ever. So that's one loop, which I call the survival trip. It's the it's just we trip out in this stress-based, ego-based loop. Or, and this is the big talk, we switch on. And that means, for me, ultimately connecting with something that gives us the resources to move out of fear and stress and into a much more creative conversation. So actually the frame of my book is around creativity. I had to choose a window to come into this world. I chose creativity because I work in innovation and I believe in creativity. But I'm talking about creativity like that, everyday creativity, which says I could think this or I could be creative with my thinking and think that. The challenge then comes in that the deeper something is, with the deeper the thing that is irritating or upsetting or frustrating us, the deeper it goes inside us, the harder it is just to think new thoughts just by pure willpower.
Yes.
So what I mean by that is, if someone said to me today, you know what, electric cars are actually much more better for the world than petrol cars, I could probably look at it and go, yeah, you're probably right. Okay, I'll change that belief. Cool. Okay, I've changed my belief. Thank you. But if someone said to me something like people never let you down.
Yeah.
And that's connected to a pain of some kind of disappointment from when I was younger, when people did let me down and it really hurt.
Yeah.
I can't just cognitively change that belief. So all the sort of cognitive behavior therapy that tries to change people's beliefs purely by just literally trying to say different things over and over again, they ultimately fail if we have a deep emotional wound that basically still believes somewhere that actually people don't look after us. And then that will become a wound forever. And then every time anyone does anything that remotely resembles this original pain, we will go, oh, see? People don't look after us, see? And then we'll react in fear or anger. So the only way to hack that, the only way to sort of short-circuit that system is to connect with something that has more love than we have fear or pain. And
yeah.
That, for me, is spirit. And
yeah.
I didn't want to be a spiritual teacher, honestly. The last thing I wanted to do with my life was be a spiritual teacher, which is why I
yes.
tried all these other things first.
Yes.
But ultimately, when you really realize that until you reconnect your heart to love, and you can call that as many different things as people want to call it, until you can give yourself the love that you didn't think you got when you were younger, the abundance of it, an absolute total love, and you feel totally loved, until you can give that to yourself, you can't get through these big, difficult, gnarly challenges. They're
yeah.
just impossible, because the system is not designed to, I believe, get through them as an ego. You have to get through them as a connected, mindful, heartful human who's interconnected with everything else. And that is where spirit comes in, and that's where the magic of healing occurs. But then, and this is the key, is then not just to stop there. So my book, the first half of the book, gets to that point, A Pace of Peace. 5 chapters, how do you heal yourself from pain through a mixture of spiritual and psychological healing. And then my belief, and this is something I am deeply passionate about, I think really connects to my generation, is, okay, now that you're feeling peaceful, now what are you going to
yeah.
do with your life? It's there's so much suffering out there in the world. What are you going to do with your life to alleviate that suffering? So for me, connecting spirituality with social change and social impact and social justice and planetary well-being is the key. So
yes.
enlightenment is the beginning of the journey, not the end. It's not the end of 30 years of, oh, I'm enlightened, awesome, I'm going to go and zone out. the whole sort of tune in, you know, drop out idea. And my kind of thing is, well, switch on and get stuck in. You know, let's get going. Do all your enlightenment stuff. Clear away your pain. Go to the ashram. Do whatever you've got to do so that you can become a useful, creative, thriving member of a community that's really doing stuff in the world, real work.
Yes, yes. Do you feel that sometimes we kind of get tricked into our life's work? Because I kind of feel like, before we came on the show, you asked me how I started this radio show, and I've been thinking about it as we've been talking, and I thought, you know, I had no idea what I was starting, really, but it was out of that notion to have an impact in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sometimes, Nick, we don't even know what we're capable of. We can't even conceive.
Absolutely.
I mean, no way would I have conceived of this. And
absolutely.
I think that's often the case. Just as, you know, you couldn't conceive perhaps long ago of being a spiritual teacher. And maybe we need to transcend that whole word spiritual, too. That's another
absolutely.
Thing is that I love
the word
of the
teacher.
Heart. I think everybody connects to that heart word, and that's showing up more and more in our language. Just, you know, not just the word, but the actual notion. That is spirit itself, and I see it everywhere now.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Yes.
I think for me, I use the word wisdom teaching rather than spiritual. It's more robust. Or heart, wisdom enterprise, heart-led enterprise, heart-led thinking.
Yes.
Yesterday, I was vibing with a colleague on the idea of using the word life-centered. So sort of life-centered work, so that it's all about bringing more life into the world, more and more thriving. So that kind of appeals to me as well. These are all old words that we can reinvent.
It's so true. And you know, words have power. They really do, because we all have certain notions of what certain words mean. And it seems we're finding ways to connect beyond the words in a way.
Absolutely.
I have another question for you, and this is very much applicable to the audience that listens during the day and my own path and several other paths. And I'd really like to get your take on it. It seems like I have lately been observing there are two ways of going about this. I have a friend, I'll use a friend who wouldn't mind me using him as an example. He was a business owner in a non-spiritual enterprise and for many years pursued spiritual enterprises. But, you know, the abundance, that part, you know, we have families or whatever, you know, that part is not yet coming through, even if the work is joyful. And so, and I'm going to ask this question in two ways, a little complex question, because this can go both ways. You can be in a job which you're making tons of money. I mean, of course, we already talked about money isn't everything, but you're supported. Okay. And you can even enjoy it quite a bit, actually, you know, depending on what you're doing. But it's still not really what you want to do. But how do we find that place? How do we find our way and break through, to use your term, to that place where we're supporting our families, we're supporting ourselves, we are thriving, and we don't have to give up? Because I'm seeing this, you know, it happens a lot. Or do we give up for a while? Yeah, what is it? Actually, that's all I'm going to say. I'm not going to even ask more of that. That pretty much puts it out there, because you can give up sometimes in the process. And okay, I'll even add that to the question. Then I'll just hand this to you for a while. Is that, what if we do give up for a while? And I'll put that in quotes.
Well,
is that really giving up? I don't know.
Exactly.
This is a really hard question that we all face.
It's one of the big questions of the age. Yeah, it's one of the biggest questions that anyone can have in their life, honestly.
Yes.
So just to shamelessly plug, I'm about to film an e-course on how to build a switched-on enterprise, a purpose-driven, heart-led enterprise that is, you know, helps you live and allows you to enjoy some wealth, but not necessarily as much as you might have done a different business model. So that's very clear key to my life has been to question that thinking. But I've got there through the reality of having to give up stuff. And so I gave up a glittering medical career when I realized it wasn't right for me, to the shock of and chagrin of pretty much everyone I knew in my family, certainly.
Yeah.
And then I gave up a very successful creative marketing agency, an ad agency in London, when I realized in a moment of inconvenient truth that it was not what my purpose was born to do, what I was born to do.
Yeah.
And so rather than try and then go, well, okay, I'll just do it for a few more years and sell it and make the few million exit that I was on offer, I just left. Why did I just leave? I designed my way out. But I knew I couldn't do it for a day longer. It was like an urgent message from what I would call the inner shaman, the shaman within you, the chokhmah in the Jewish tradition, wisdom, your inner truth, whatever you want to call that thing. I was being told, absolutely do not do this for another second now that you're aware and awake, which is incredibly inconvenient and really annoying. But I had to do it. And so that really is when I started this career I'm in now, in a committed way. But I have tried, on this last 10 years, I've tried three or four different business models to try and work out how to make it work. I think, so there's another layer within the question that you've asked, I think. Which is, just as a point of I think, a clarity. I don't necessarily mean that everyone then has to leave what they do.
Right.
I think you can bring your purpose and bring it into your existing work.
Yes.
Once you find your purpose, and I define purpose as something like love in action, or the bridge between your heart and the heartaches of the world, you can bring that purpose into any career, any job, any work, whether it's washing windows or running a Fortune 100 company. You can bring it into that work. So you don't have to leave, but you do have to be clear whether you're really bringing it into your work or whether you're fudging it just so that you can keep on having membership of the tennis club and your second or third home and all the other things. You have to be really clear with yourself and not bullshit yourself. If you're not living a purpose-driven life, the only person who's going to suffer really is you, most of all.
Yeah.
And the world too, ultimately. So that's just, I don't want to run out and quit their jobs or end their businesses. But you have to really dialogue with your inner wisdom around that. But once you do know what your purpose is, there are many different ways to skin the cat. So I would say that you do not get to choose your purpose, but you do get to choose what you do with it. And that becomes the great choice of how do I live out my purpose? And it may not include being rich. This is something where I actually challenge the defining, what one of the memes in the U.S., particularly U.S., but now also U.K., sort of spiritual scene around manifestation and whatever. The universe has plans for us that we have no concept of. We're a co-creator in those plans. We're part of those plans. But we're only one part of it as individuals. And it just may not involve being rich. It may involve being not rich or okay or any number of things to really live out our purpose. My hunch is we can still make things work for ourselves.
Yes.
And that's why I believe in what I call Switch on Enterprise, which is an enterprise which is both heart-led but also socially and sustainably oriented, but also can make money. There's nothing wrong with having an income coming in for things. So the business I'm building called Ripe and Ready, which is, if you kind of imagine Hay House meets Vice Magazine and has babies. It's kind of like a 21st century media company for wisdom and world change ideas for young people particularly. We are looking at what we call the quadruple bottom line, which means how are we going to make money and make a revenue? Because I've got two small children and I'm the sole provider for four people.
That's
so
important.
It's very important that I don't just run off into my spiritual practice and go, I'm just going to be a guru and sit here and look at the wall for a while. So how can I make revenue that's fair and just and not overpriced but not underpriced? How can I make sure that we minimize damage to the planet? How do we make sure that we empower and include social problems? So one of our commitments is never to run a personal development program unless we can find a way to also give it away for free in some form to marginalized groups. And then four, how do you make sure that everyone involved is living their purpose and actually playful and enjoys it and it's actually fun and engaging work? So that's what we call the quadruple bottom line. And it doesn't. It sounds complex, and it is a little bit. You have to really think. You can't just go, okay, I'm going to build a dry cleaners, and it's going to be my purpose project. It's like, nah, unlikely, unless you can find a way to connect it to people suffering. But it doesn't mean you have to be a pauper. And I think if you've got any belief systems around either having to have lots of money or having to have no money, they're probably not really appropriate. They're probably not no longer fit for purpose. They're probably old stuff. Because I don't think the universe wants you to be suffering and having no money. Neither do I think it wants you necessarily to, have $100 million. But some kind of middle ground. The middle way is usually the way.
You know what's interesting, Nick, is whether we've experienced it ourselves or we've known people who've had lots of money, and we all know people. I would wager almost all of us know people or maybe have experienced it to a point. That doesn't buy happiness. People say that, just say it, money doesn't buy happiness, but it really doesn't. There can be real misery, even if you have all the wealth. I mean, there we get back to what you said before.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I do believe, and this is really true in the spiritual community, that there can be this pattern that many get caught up into. And really, when we're parents, we can't get caught up in that parent, this particular pattern of not getting the abundance side right. That doesn't mean you have to be rich.
Absolutely.
Can simplify. I think that we learn not to be as materialistic, Nick, just through experience. I look at my own life and how I used to walk in a store and just say, I want that, and get it.
Exactly.
Well, I don't do that anymore. And you know what? I realized I don't need to do that. Why do I need a new whatever? I don't. I don't need
it. One of the triggers for me leaving my agency was being in I think it was Switzerland, in a business class lounge in the airport, tired and exhausted and feeling run down and not, and doing work that wasn't really contributing to anything.
Yeah.
And then going off to the duty free and just spending $100 on something that just to feel a little better in that moment. And I had like a kind of quantum spectacles moment, and I was like, oh my God, I am just literally helping one part of the capitalist machine through marketing, whilst then using capitalism, using products, consumerism as a way of feeling better about that. And I was like, oh my God. I'm literally deeply unconscious. I'm switched off. I'm just going through the motions. And that was one of the triggers is there's nothing wrong with having stuff. I enjoy I enjoy wearing great clothes and fashion and design and all sorts of lovely things. So I don't believe to be a wisdom teacher you have to suddenly start wearing Indian clothes. It's just like crazy to me. Why can't I wear the same sharp London style, New York style I had before? I'd have to change my whole thing. Mm-hmm. But as long as I always know that if I had to wear a lungi, loincloth and a T-shirt, the same one for the rest of my life, I'd be okay. It's not a biggie.
Uh-huh.
And that's that middle path again. So, and to bring it right down to brass tacks, I'm designing a what people will call a sign-up form for workshops. So I'm running the switch-on workshops, the sort of deep version of the book, and then I'm running the switch-on enterprise workshops. So I want to get people on both those workshops. So I download from the internet someone else's personal development workshop form, and here's the choice. Here's the choice. Do I make it quite manipulative, like a lot of those forms are?
Yes,
where they say, you could get for this minus this, you could get this, which is worth this amount, and you're
going
to get this for free, which is all using all this persuasion theory.
Mm-hmm.
Or, that's one extreme. The other extreme is I don't even give people a form. They even really talk about it and go, a mumble, that I've got a workshop and, it would be really good. I'm embarrassed about my own value, my own product. And the middle ground has to be, give people a choice, make it really clear what you think this workshop is and why it's good. Trust that if you think it's good, it probably is good and it has value for people. But also, don't manipulate them and let them make their own choice freely whether they want to be in part of it or not. And that for me, is purpose-driven business choices. It's about not saying, it's about making sure there's no crazy stuff about, I should be poor, my stuff is no good, all that stuff. Who needs it? The universe is certainly not, I don't believe, wanting you to have those thoughts or feelings. But neither is it going, ha-ha, I want to make a million this year, and then I want to make another, that whole kind of thing. So it's just about those moment-by-moment choices, tapping in, reconnect the heart. What do I sense about this? What's a purposeful way through this choice? And making a choice and sitting with it and feeling it, and does it feel appropriate? In the book, I don't know if you've seen this, I use this term fitted a lot, which is a kind of word like appropriate. And on my second book that I'm working on at the moment, I'm actually looking at sort of trying to recontextualize evolutionary theory, which talks about fitness, which is defined as the ability to reproduce and, pass on your genes.
Yeah.
And that makes sense in one level of reality. But I believe there's this other thing called fittedness, which is about thriving. So fitness helps us survive if we're fit. But fittedness helps us thrive. And what I mean by fittedness is a fittedness to our environment and to the way the world is in this moment. Do the beliefs we have fit this world now? not the one 20 years ago, not the one when I was a kid, this moment now. And that is a very beautiful question to ask oneself regularly. Does this fit this moment?
Yeah.
Am I fitting this moment? Am I bringing the most appropriate response to this moment? Very powerful question.
Yes. You know, I might say, as you're saying this, Nick, you know, it was in a way synchronistic how we organically flowed into your being able to talk about your purpose of how you're applying it in this new way. That was not planned. You know, some people, they listen to talk shows, they think they're all planned. You know, they're like infomercials or something. Not this show.
There was no plan here.
No plan. Actually, I had no idea you were even going to mention that, or, you know, I didn't have really an awareness. And so that's it. That's it right there. Because what you know is there's a need, and I know there's a need, and I feel it, and you just happen to be able to talk about that, and that's organic flow, I feel.
It is, it's flow, it's creative, it's being free. So
yeah.
It's like, same thing, there is no value in me here on this radio show pretending that, you know, being falsely modest or not or holding back or whatever, but neither is there value, neither is it appropriate or fitted for me to be puffing myself up and you know, neither of those things are useful to anyone, least of all me. And so therefore, the, you know, that's what then when you're not doing that, that's when flow happens, is when you are literally creating in the moment, appropriately tapping in, feeling connected, not feeling scared.
Yes.
And it literally, it's like, and it sounds super weirdly mystic, it always works.
Yes.
And I work in very senior environments, and I also work in with low-income kids, or I work in a festival, and they're all very different environments.
Mm-hmm.
But if I stay tuned in, switched on, and just connected to me, my body, particularly I'm very big believer in embodied intelligence, that we have the intelligence we need in our feelings, in our sensations, in our gut, in our solar plexus. If we keep on being attuned to that, it will give us all the guidance we need in those moments.
Yeah.
And there's actually a wonderful quote in the book from Bodhidharma, who was the first Zen patriarch, the big first Zen teacher 1,000 years ago or whatever it was, who says something like, the fools look for sages outside, the sage is always within, you know, and what I in the book call our inner shaman. You know, we don't need a shaman to guide us, to do it for us. We might need to guide us. So I talk about my work. I don't really even talk about coaching anymore. I find that word kind of redundant, weird, no longer fitting. I talk about really guiding. So I've been on a journey. It's like a tour guide. I've been here before.
Yeah.
Not only been here, I've also thought about it quite a lot, and I've done some lots of research about this place. It doesn't mean it's mine. It doesn't mean I own it. It doesn't mean I have a privileged access to it. But if you're here for the first time, I can really help you enjoy a great experience. And then when you, you know, have enough of my guidance, go and get a different guide. Go a different place. No.
I love that. It's a connection to the real. I mean, that's what it is. That word coach, that's another one. I mean, everybody's – that word has all kinds of nuances that we don't – you know, that people place on it. You're just being real. And, you know, when we're real, we can connect. You know, I'll be honest with you, Nick. When I read all your credentials, this happens to me often. You know, I think, oh, my gosh, look at this. you know, it's very impressive, right? Well, but what are we? We're just people.
Exactly.
I mean, we can all connect. And I'm sure that's how you connect to government leaders, too. We're just people solving problems and
working through. As I get older, I become much more aware of that. And in fact, I'm not even a big fan of all that bio stuff, but some people, it's important to get above their radar. You need to give them some of that stuff. So they see a lot of people who call themselves
a life coach.
And they're like, God, just yet another person. And to go, well, actually, you know, he's talking at number 10 and got a Cambridge degree and blah, blah, all that stuff. People go, oh, okay, fine. He's popped above my... But for me, that's just enormous irrelevance to anything. Really, because it's nothing to do with who I am. It's just things I've done, and they're very different things. And but we live in a world which likes stars. And that's, I think, one of the shadows of the world right now. I see it actually more in the US than I do in Europe. But still, just as prevalent, this desire to put people up and go, you're the star. you're going to get the prize, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Nobel Prize. From they all reward individuals without realizing that no scientist in the world makes their discoveries alone. At minimum, they have, you know, a team of unpaid PhD slaves. The boring work, right? Plus, they have all their collaborators and who the people they talk to about it. There's nothing happens in an individual. This book, although it came through me and I was the one who spent the long nights writing it, and I want to own that, and I'm, you know, proud of that. It's not mine. I don't own this knowledge. It's, you know, it's not about me. It's just about, you know, and there's something very important about that, I think, and it's something I've been talking a lot about with my Wisdom Media company, because one of the things we're trying to do is bring a lot of the what I would call next generation wisdom teachers. We want to bring them up and help them get established and give them a voice, because I've experienced it being quite challenging, young and new in the scene. So you want to help them come up, but we really believe that for the digital generations, they don't need gurus. They don't want gurus. We come up in a world of peer-to-peer, Airbnb, PayPal. It's all peer-to-peer, right? There's this whole idea of someone above someone doesn't really cut it. Yet at the same time, we don't want to set, you know, you do need a little bit of what one might call, I don't know what one would call it, a bit of hubris. I talk about in the book about balancing hubris and humility. The hubris is the belief that you can make a difference to the world as one person, and the humility to know that nothing you can do makes a difference to the grand majesty of the universe. And that trying to be in the middle of that, that creative tension, is where life is the most rich.
Captured that so beautifully. I don't know if we have time to bring in another real person. I actually have a caller who's very patiently been waiting on the line. So maybe I'm going to ask him. I know this caller. He's a great caller to the show. And if he could ask just a quick question, just to, because I know he's been so patient. So I'm going to bring Jay on the line really quick and just let him ask you a question. If I can get him on the line. He's a little hesitant. There we are. Welcome, Jay. Are you there?
Yes, I am. It's a great show. Listen to it.
Oh, thank you. Do you have a question for Nick?
Hey, Nick, I just wondered, what is it people always have, I don't know, are hesitant to step out of their means or bounds or conformity? Cause I just find that we kind of like people who are really, I want to say it, creative, often get mocked at because they go outside the bounds of what society norms are or anything like that. So I just wondered, what are you doing to teach other people about that?
Well, there's a great quote from Jeff Bezos at Amazon, the CEO of Amazon, who says, if you want to do disruptive innovation, you have to prepare to be misunderstood for a very long time. And that is definitely true. I mean, I've had to really understand that I don't fit, my job description doesn't fit in to anyone else's pigeonholes. I have to put down like 5 different job descriptions to even give a sense of the things I'm involved in, which really irritates people. It kind of irritates me too sometimes. It's kind of like, oh, really? Can't I just fit in a pigeonhole? But my life just doesn't, partly because I'm ahead of the pigeonholes, so I'm building the new pigeonholes of the future. And so it is challenging, you know, not be able to give people a clear answer to what you do at a dinner party or a cocktail party, or your friends sort of, you know, just not getting it. But so what I work with my participants, clients, I don't know what even the word is for people who I work with, I try and help them build the inner resilience you need, which ultimately is about purpose, to know that what you're doing is important and vital and real and true, and it really doesn't matter at all what anyone else thinks, whilst at the same time knowing that other people's feedback can be extremely helpful. Feedback and blind spots are very helpful to make sure we don't run off in hubristic creative vision and actually build something no one really wants. So it's really about connecting with your own inner resource, your own inner integrity. At the same time, I also suggest, which can be very sad for people, that they distance themselves, not emotionally, but practically, if you like, from the people who are the naysayers and the doubters and the questioners and the negative people. Not love them any less, but just spend less time with them, because they're not contributing to where you really much to where you need to be. And instead, find people who get it. So I travel the world doing my thing. At the moment, I'm in San Francisco. And yesterday, I met up with 7 different people, 3 of which I've never met before, 2 from random emails that they sent me. And they're my community. They're my friends. They're the people who are also at this edge of their fields, bringing wisdom and heart into their areas, you know, trying to connect the dots in their space. And we are the community. And there are now places online and Facebook groups and whatever where you can join those. You can join a global tribe of people who are questioning the status quo, finding new ways to do things. And they give me enormous amount of nourishment just to know that they're there. Some people I haven't even ever met. They're just Skype friends. Mm-hmm. And they're it's way more nourishing to me than most of my old friends, who I love and love partying with sometimes and hanging out with. But in terms of nourishing the work I do, I need to be around people who are doing the work themselves and part of this new emerging tribe.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, well, thanks, Jay, for calling the show. And wow, what an answer. I mean, Nick, you know, as I often say, we're racing towards the end of the live show. That seems to be well, lately I've had such amazing guests. Come on, it happens. And I'm glad we were able to incorporate Jay's question as well.
Yes,
but,
really,
you know,
let me
just say, I mean, from my heart, thank you. Thank you for being here today. You know, there's just so much to learn from you. I am just so happy to have discovered you in the world, I guess I will say, and I hope that many will.
Likewise.
So, thank you. And please do remind people where they can find out about your work, Nick.
Yes, well, the easiest way, I've got lots of, so the Wisdom Media website is ripe as in ripe fruit, ripeandready.com. But if you want to find out about me, it's simplest place just to go to Nick Jankel, NickJankel, and there's meditations and some free stuff, and you can get a free sample of the book, and then toolkits and experiences and stuff I do with governments as well there, if you're interested, and you can sort of root around a little bit about my polymath areas of thinking, which, you know, take me into all sorts of different places.
Yes. Well, I do hope that people explore everything that you're sharing, because you really are giving us tremendous gifts as a guide, and
right.
I am very thankful for that. So once again, thank you so much for being here today.
Really, thank you for giving me space to share.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed it immensely. Thank you so much.
Likewise.
All right.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Okay, as fast as I can manage before the live show goes down, the next show the next show next week is Tuesday, April 7th, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Sunita Patani will be talking about a new book, The Transcendent Mind. And then next Thursday, April 9th, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, Stuart Pierce is coming back to the show. It's been, I think over a year, and he's quite a delightful soul. He's going to talk about angels and the keys to paradise, and he even coached Princess Diana, So yet another amazingly connected individual, but all real. We're all real together, and that's what matters. That's what matters in this world. Here I sit looking at the trees of Oregon, just in my house talking and just enjoying these wonderful conversations, which you can learn more about at frontierbeyondfear.com. And I do invite you to visit that site because we're getting quite an archive together, which I keep wanting to organize a little bit better. And I'll get those upgrades to the site in there as we go. but I do invite you to frontierbeyondfear.com. And thank you, everyone, for being here today. May you find ways to switch on.